Good day. Today is Saturday, 4th October 2025, and before I start with the substance of the programme, just a brief announcement. Tomorrow I am travelling to Oxford. I am leaving London early in the morning, and I expect that I will be returning late at night. I will be very busy throughout all of the time that I am there, and I'm afraid I cannot guarantee that I will be able to get a video done tomorrow. And if I do, it will be a very short one and probably one made very early in the morning. Just saying. So that may mean that important news, if it happens over the course of the day, might happen at a time when I'm not able to comment on it. There is a possibility, for example, that there might be an attack on Venezuela over the next 24 hours or 48 hours. There's been an article in the Washington Examiner, a very well-connected publication in Washington, which suggests that that might be the case. But as I said, if it does happen, whilst I'm on my travels, well, apologies in advance. I will have to pick up on it when I return to London and am able to do programmes in a more normal way. Anyway, with that, let me now get on to the substance of this programme. And I'm now going to return to the topic of President Putin's speech and question and answer session at the Valdai conference, which took place in Russia. It's an extensive speech, an extensive Q&A. I dealt with it in broad brush terms yesterday, but I'm going to focus more today on some of the specific points that President Putin made over the course of the speech, and perhaps most especially over the course of the Q&A. Now, a number of people are suggesting, in fact, I would go so far as to say that it is a general consensus that in speaking about President Trump of the United States, President Putin expressed himself in moderate and precise language. And I think that is basically true. He wasn't rude or aggressive about Trump, but then realistically, he wasn't rude or aggressive about anybody. As we will see in a short while, he said things about President Macron, who he clearly doesn't like. And in his usual way, Putin nonetheless basically mocked Macron with self-praise. Putin is very unusual amongst world leaders, but follows a Soviet and Russian tradition of being basically, as the leader of Russia, polite about the leaders that he has to deal with. He was astonishingly polite, for example, about President Biden of the United States, despite the truly terrible things that President Biden used to say about him. So when people say that Putin was polite and friendly towards Trump, it really doesn't deviate much from normal Russian diplomatic practice and from Putin's style. But I think it also risks taking away from the fact that over the course of this question and answer, Putin didn't give an inch on any substantive point. He made no concessions to the United States, to President Trump at all, certainly not on any matter that pertains to Russia. And as we will see over the course of this programme, on most of the issues of substance, he was also quite firm. And on the specific issue of deployment of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, of transfer of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine and their use against Russia. About that, he was very firm and gave what I thought was a fairly clear warning. Anyway, let's begin. Let's go through some of the comments that Putin made over the course of this Q&A and this speech. Firstly, there's the comment about Russia being a paper tiger, which was made by Donald Trump, in that now notorious or infamous or famous Truth Social post. Putin was asked to comment about that. And it's important to say that this whole conversation would have been broadcast to people in Russia, and they would have heard and seen it. They, of course, know that President Trump referred to Russia as a paper tiger, and they will have been very interested to hear what Vladimir Putin had to say in response. So the moderator of the Q&A, the journalist, very prominent Russian journalist, Fyodor Lukyanov, asked Putin this question. He said he, that is to say Trump, taunts us as a paper tiger. What about that? And then Putin responded, a paper tiger? As I have said, Russia has not been fighting the armed forces of Ukraine or Ukraine itself these past years, but effectively the entire NATO bloc. And then he goes into a long, detailed discussion, but a very precise discussion, about the situation on the battlefronts. He says that the town of Volchansk is about to fall entirely under Russian control. He said that two-thirds of Kupiansk are now under Russian control, and that the central district of Kupiansk is now under Russian control and is about to fall. He said that the Russians have entered Konstantinovka and fighting is taking place there, and that this is the key defense line comprising Konstantinovka, Slavyansk, and Kramatorsk. These fortifications were developed by the Ukrainians over more than a decade with the assistance of Western specialists, yet our troops have now penetrated these defences with combat ongoing there. And he said that the same applies to Siversk, that the Russians have broken into Siversk as well. He then discusses Pokrovsk. He says that the situation in Pokrovsk is progressing in Russian favour, but with characteristic Putinist humour, he says, I will not refrain from excessive detail, not least because I have no desire to inform of our adversary, paradoxical as that may sound. Why? Because they are in disarray, scarcely comprehending the situation themselves. Providing them additional clarity serves no purpose. Rest assured, our personnel are executing their duties with confidence. And of course, what Putin is mocking here are the various Ukrainian claims about successful counterattacks in the Pokrovsk area, and the Ukrainian claims to have cut off and surrounded Russian troops northeast of Pokrovsk. And then he says that the Russians are continuing their advance in Zaporozhye and Dnipro region. Well, I've been discussing all of this, all of the things that Putin has just said, in great detail. And then Putin comes back to the question of Russia being a paper tiger. Yet, if we are combating the entire NATO alliance, advancing with unwavering confidence, and are deemed a paper tiger, what does that make NATO itself? What matter of entity is it then? But never mind that. What matters most is to have confidence in ourselves, and we do. So what Putin is saying is, look, They call us a paper tiger. They've armed Ukraine to the best extent that they can. They've given Ukraine every weapon that Ukraine up to now has asked for. They have imposed massive sanctions upon us. They've done everything they possibly can to break us. But instead, it is we who are advancing. And then he turns it round and he says that if NATO has done all of this, but cannot push Russia back, but it is Russia that is advancing, it cannot be Russia that is the paper tiger. It might, in that case, be NATO. Now, this was, of course, a quip to my complete lack of surprise. Some people in the West, some media outlets in the West, turned it round and presented it as some kind of a threat. It clearly wasn't intended as a threat. It was a reply to a taunt that had been made against Russia by Donald Trump. So, just saying. Anyway, Putin was asked about this situation with the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The narrative has been spread most specifically by President Zelensky that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is on the brink of a major accident. Zelensky has made the remarkable claim that even though the Russians control the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, they are themselves shelling the power plant that they themselves control. And, well, Putin was asked to comment about that. And to summarise, he ridiculed the suggestion that it is the Russians who are shelling the power plant that they control. He made it clear that it is, in fact, the Ukrainians that are doing so. He claimed that Rafael Grossi and the IAEA, who have their specialists in the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, know this very well, though he implied that they are either intimidated by the West or in alignment by the West, and this prevents them from saying that. But perhaps more specifically, Putin went on to say this. This is a dangerous game. And he's talking to addressing the Ukrainians now. This is a dangerous game. People on the other side, that is to say the Ukrainians, should also understand if they play with this so recklessly, they have operating nuclear power plants on their side too. So what would prevent us from responding in kind? They should think about that. This is the first point. And then he discusses all of the other things that I've said. Now, that is a fairly clear warning to the Ukrainians that, you know, these continuous attacks on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant are beyond reckless. They might indeed trigger a nuclear accident. And though the Russians have not so far done anything similar in response, two can certainly play at this game. Ukraine is more dependent on its nuclear power plants than the Russians obviously are on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And, well, anyway, if the Russians were to start doing to Ukrainian nuclear power plants what the Ukrainians are doing with the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, well, Ukraine would pay a catastrophic price. Putin then said something else. He said, I should add that Ukrainian sabotage and reconnaissance groups have repeatedly attempted similar actions in recent months and even last year. They blew up high voltage transmission lines at the Kursk nuclear power plant and the Smolensk nuclear power plant, sneaking in through the forests to do it. Our specialists repaired those lines very quickly. Now, I've heard rumours about this, and I have made known my own belief that the objective of the Kursk operation, the Kursk offensive that Ukraine carried out last year, was to capture the Kursk nuclear power plant. And the Russians have made it perfectly clear that that is what they think also. Just saying. But here we see Putin say that the Ukrainians have not only conducted drone attacks against the Kursk nuclear power plant, which is what the Russians have claimed in the past. There have been Russian claims to that effect. And in fact, there's been pictures of drones appearing to hit the Kursk nuclear power plant. But the Russians are also saying that sabotage groups have been inserted by Ukraine into Kursk and Smolensk regions, and that they've blown up high voltage transmission lines with the obvious intention, with the clear intention, of creating nuclear accidents. So this is a very serious accusation indeed. The media in the West, by the way, I notice has completely ignored it. One would like to see some concern expressed about an accusation of this kind. And one would also like to see some research, some investigations done by third parties to see whether or not Putin's claim here is true. I would have thought that Rafael Grossi and the IAEA, for example, would absolutely want to be in on an investigation of this kind, or at least they should be if they were doing their job properly, as we have seen with the recent conflicts in Iran and with Putin's comments about the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. There are good reasons to think that they are not. Anyway, I am not here corroborating what Putin has said. I don't myself have any reason to doubt that what he is saying is true. But of course, I don't know. All I am saying is that he has made this claim that the Ukrainians have tried to engineer accidents at the Kursk and Smolensk nuclear power plants. And, well, given the gravity of that allegation and given the reality that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is being shelled, I would have thought the right thing to do would be for people to go and check and find out whether those allegations are true, and for the IAEA to ask the Russians for permission to conduct its own independent investigation, something which it seems to show no desire or wish to do. So that's both a warning from Putin and a threat that if Ukraine continues these attempts to attack or set up accidents at nuclear power plants that are either indisputably Russian, like the Kursk and Smolensk nuclear power plants, or like the one in Zaporizhzhia, which the Russians control, that the Russians can also play that game too. So we had that very clear threat, and we had that very alarming claim, which, as I said, nobody seems to have taken seriously. Anyway, we then had Putin's comment about the French seizure of the oil tanker, the one that was transporting oil from Russia, presumably to China. It has a Chinese captain, though it was flying under the flag of Benin. And Putin had this to say. Yes, I know about this incident. The tanker was seized in neutral waters without any reason whatsoever. Well, that's not completely true, because, of course, the French are claiming that they have reasons to believe that this tanker was being used to launch the drones that were interfering with the airport in Copenhagen. Not that any evidence has been produced to substantiate that claim, and that particular tanker has apparently since been released and is steaming with its cargo, presumably in the direction of China. Anyway, Putin then goes on to say they were probably looking for some military consignments, including drones or something like that. They found nothing, as the ship carried no such items. Well, I don't know what Putin's basis for saying that is, but it is in fact the case that the French have provided no evidence that they found anything suspect or suspicious or untoward on the ship, nothing to suggest that there were drones or guidance systems for drones or anything like that on the ship. And then Putin continues, indeed the tanker was sailing under the flag of a third country and was operated by an international crew. I do not know how this can be linked with Russia, but I know that this fact did take place. What is this all about? Is it really important for France? Yes, it is important. Do you know why? Considering the difficult situation for the ruling French elite, they have no other way of distracting the attention of their population. French citizens from complicated and hard to resolve problems in the French Republic itself. As I have already said in my remarks, they want very much to transfer the tension from inside France to the external contour, to excite some other forces, other countries, in particular Russia, to provoke us into some vigorous actions and to tell the people of France that they should rally around their leader who will lead them to victory like Napoleon. Then Lukyanov interjected, "You have flattered the president of France." And then Putin responded, "I did this with pleasure. Both of us maintain a good-natured working relationship. The current developments just mentioned by me are exactly what is happening. I do not doubt this. I know him well." So there you have it. Putin goading and teasing Macron. You want to play the part of Napoleon. You want to get through your current problems in France by setting up some kind of clash with us, with Russia. I know you very well. I know your Napoleon complex through and through. But don't worry, I'm not going to fall for your game. I'm just going to sit back and let you stew. That essentially is what Putin said. And you can see that his comment, "I do this with pleasure. Both of us maintain a good-natured working relationship. We're friends." Now, again, to repeat, when Putin talks in this way, he's never openly rude about other leaders. And he was not rude about Donald Trump. At another point in the interview, he said that he had a comfortable working relationship with Trump. And Lukyanov responded that you must be the only person on earth, or at least the only leader on earth, who finds Trump a comfortable person to deal with. And then Putin responded, "Well, you know, he's a flamboyant personality. Sometimes he says things in a rather harsh way. But, you know, that's fine. It's better that that is done in that kind of way sometimes than that people engage in complicated and evasive comments. And, well, overall, the relationship between us is good." If Putin says that the relationship between him and himself and Macron is good, then when he says that his relationship with Trump is comfortable and good, you should realize that you need to be careful. People should not assume that things are quite as easy as on the surface these words might imply. I think that far too few Westerners understand the irony that is being deployed here. Irony, by the way, being something that is very much used in Russia. It's very much part of the way in which speech is conducted at multiple levels. It's very much a part of Russian humour. And we see that Putin himself is very skilled at it. Well, Putin, of course, had other things to say. And here was the one point in the entire Q&A when Putin was evasive. And it was, again, about the question of the European Union. Now, this is, in my opinion, the major issue, the major point of conflict now between Putin and the rest of the Russian elite. There's been much speculation about the view that overall the Russian elite, some members of the Russian elite, the hardliners, are becoming impatient with Putin. There's even talk that some kind of a coup is being prepared against him, or that he might be ousted because the elite, the hardliners in the elite, are losing patience. I don't myself believe any of that. I think that there is constant argument and constant debate and discussion. I think the secret of Putin's political success and longevity as a political leader is that he adapts himself and shifts his position as the facts change and as the arguments change. I think that the one serious point of conflict between the hardliners, if you will, and Putin himself is that Putin has consistently up to now taken the stance that whilst Russia strongly objects, it is an absolute uncrossable red line for Russia, strongly objects to Ukraine entering NATO. Russia does not object to Ukraine entering the EU because the EU is a commercial trade association. And Russia does not concern itself with how countries decide their economic and trade relations or which trade associations they choose to join. Security and defence alliances are one thing, but trade associations are something completely different. The EU, as a trade association, it is none of Russia's business whether Ukraine joins it or not. Now, I have said in programme after programme recently that this position is becoming increasingly difficult to sustain, for Putin to sustain in Russia, that the changes that the EU itself is undertaking, its push towards militarisation, Ursula von der Leyen's statements that the EU needs to acquire a more military dimension, and some of the actions that the European Union is taking, for example, its plans to confiscate, to seize Russian assets, disguised under various kinds of pretexts, that all of this is pulling the rug from under the feet of Putin's argument that the EU is merely an innocuous trade association and that Putin is becoming increasingly isolated within Russia, within the Kremlin, for sticking to it. And we have seen recently, quite recently, that over the course of a brief press conference, Putin was challenged on this very point by his favourite journalist, Pavel Zarubin. He stuck rather unconvincingly to his historic line that it is not Russia's business whether Ukraine joins the EU or not. But over the course of this Q&A, he was challenged on this very same point again. And this was the question. The European Union has become increasingly like NATO lately. If we look at how they're handling the Ukraine crisis, it's very clear. And this is how I see it. Ukraine will be the West's fist, the EU's fist, the EU's army. And then, if it becomes a member of the EU, it will even threaten Russia. What do you think about this? Now, the questioner put this question and also asked Putin various other questions about the EU and about the development of the EU and about Europe in general. But that was, in a sense, the punchline of his question. And the fascinating, the very interesting thing about Putin's answer is that he didn't answer it. He completely avoided giving an answer. Instead, he launched, as Putin sometimes does, on a long discussion about Russia's interactions with the EU, his own interactions with the EU, the good relations he once had with Chancellor Kohl, how Europe is gradually losing its cultural moorings and is losing its way, how Russian liberals, who used to be enormously enthusiastic about Europe, are losing their enthusiasm for it, how all of those things, but he didn't address the specific question. Look, the EU is becoming, in effect, a military alliance, one that is hostile to Russia. It is no different from NATO, so how can we continue to agree that Ukraine should join the EU? This is the second time that Putin has been directly challenged on this very point, and this time he's refused to address the question. He's not disagreed with his questioner. He's not said you're wrong. It's still a trade association. It's Ukraine's prerogative to choose which trade association it joins. This time, on the contrary, Putin evaded giving an answer. Now, as far as I'm concerned, what that means is that this discussion is continuing within the Kremlin. It's probably been brought up repeatedly in the various meetings of the Security Council. It's quite clear to me that Medvedev, the public face, if you like, of the Russian hardliners, and by the way, Lavrov, no longer think it is in any way a good idea for Russia to stand aside and let Ukraine join the EU. The fact that Putin didn't respond or push back on this point in this important Q&A leads me to think that gradually he is edging towards the position of the hardliners on this point. I've been saying so for several months now, and I think that at some point, fairly soon, we're going to see him come out straightforwardly and say, or at least the Russians come out straightforwardly and say, that Ukraine's entry into the EU is no longer acceptable for Russia. So that's an interesting shift by Putin. And to be frank, given the amount of time and energy that is being given to bringing Ukraine into the EU, I'm a little surprised that no one has picked up on it. Anyway, the last point about this press conference that I want to touch on relates to the Tomahawk missiles. Now, Alex Cristoforo and I did a long program about this very topic on the Duran. We discussed whether or not for the Russians, the supply of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine would be a red line, and whether or not, if the Tomahawks were indeed provided to Russia, that would create a permanent rupture between Russia and the United States and would bring finally and completely to an end any talk of a detente in any form between the United States and Russia. And I know that there are many people who still believe that Putin is weak and soft on this issue. On the program, on that program that Alex Cristoforo and I did, which came out before Putin made these comments, I said that I have absolutely no doubt that if Tomahawk missiles are supplied to Ukraine and are launched from Ukrainian territory against Russia, that will be it. All further steps towards a rapprochement or a detente between Russia and the United States will be ended. Anyway, that was my view, and Putin has now confirmed it. So he was asked, and he was asked this question: a discussion has begun in the West about two potential escalation points, the supply of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine and the potential seizure of ships carrying Russian cargo on the high seas, not just in territorial waters. Can you tell us your opinions on how dangerous this is and how Russia would respond to it? Now, I'm going to leave to one side just for the moment the question of seizing ships on the high seas. This is what Putin had to say about the Tomahawks. It's dangerous. As for the Tomahawks, they're a powerful weapon. True, they're no longer entirely modern, but they are powerful and pose a threat. Of course, this won't change. It won't change the balance on the battlefield at all. I've already said the fundamental problem of the Ukrainian armed forces, no matter how much you saturate them with drones, no matter how much you create seemingly impenetrable defense lines with drones, is that there are no personnel. There's no one to fight. Do you understand? I talked about changing combat tactics due to new technology, but look at what we see on television showing our troops advancing. Yes, it takes time, two or three at a time, but we are advancing. Electronic warfare is working. They're suppressing the drones, and we are advancing. The same will happen here. So what was the case with the Attrakums? Yes, they caused some damage. Eventually, our air defense systems adapted despite their high supersonic capabilities and began to shoot them down. Can Tomahawks harm us? Yes, they can. Will we shoot them down? Yes, we will. We will improve our air defenses. Will this damage our relations, which have seen some light at the end of the tunnel? Of course it will. How could it not? Using Tomahawks without the direct participation of American military personnel is impossible. This would mark a completely new, qualitatively new stage of escalation, including in relations between Russia and the United States. So again, the language is measured, the language is moderate, which is the style that Russian leaders choose to adopt. I would add, even during the Second World War, Joseph Stalin was surprisingly moderate on most occasions in talking about his German adversaries. It is the tradition in Russia for the leader himself to talk in this measured and moderate way. Other officials are allowed much wider license. But anyway, Putin follows the tradition, as he usually does on most things. He speaks moderately. He says, however, quite clearly, look, we know all about the Tomahawks. We know how it works. We know that in order for you to launch Tomahawk missiles against us, your military personnel would have to be involved. It wouldn't be just the Ukrainians attacking us with Tomahawk missiles. It would be you as well. You, the United States, would be doing it as well. And it's very dangerous for you to do. And be under no illusions, if you do it, then all talk of improving relations, of détente, of the kind of talk about the improving relations in the sense of the light being there at the end of the tunnel, all that is off the table. It would be an act of qualitatively new escalation, and it would catapult our relations not just into a state of deep freeze, back into a state of deep freeze, but one back, but now into a state of outright conflict. So I think the words here are completely clear. Again, people should not mistake the care with which they're chosen and the moderate language that is used with the message. And perhaps the main story of this entire Q&A is that Putin repeatedly spoke about the fact that he is the leader of a country which, yes, it does extend the velvet glove, but it has a mailed fist. He speaks about how the Russian army is defeating the Ukrainian army. He speaks about how Russia continues to advance. He speaks about how NATO has attempted to wage, through its Ukrainian proxy, this war against Russia in Ukraine, and the whole of NATO is losing that conflict. Elsewhere in the programme, in the Q&A rather, he talks about the various weapons capabilities that the Russians have, the way in which they're a nuclear power, the way that they've taken steps to ensure their own security. He made a very interesting observation, by the way, about the Oreshnik missile, whose deployment he also confirmed. He said that when the Russians have floated discussions about strategic arms reduction, the Americans have come back and have said that the Oreshnik, though a non-nuclear system, should be included in those discussions because of its range, its ability, perhaps from eastern Russia, to reach locations on the western seaboard of the continental United States. He wasn't drawn into that, by the way. What he said was that if there are such negotiations and such demands are made, and if the United States continues to insist that China is included in those negotiations, and if the Chinese do participate in them, then the Russians will insist that Britain and France participate in the negotiations also and put their own nuclear capabilities on the table. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss any of that in this programme. But the point is that Putin, using his measured language, warning the Americans, you know, step here at your peril, go ahead if you want and give Ukraine Tomahawk cruise missiles, we will quickly get on top of them. Our air defense system will rapidly adapt to whatever threat they pose. We don't discount the threat, but we can adapt to it. It will not win the war for Ukraine. General Kellogg's claim that the Tomahawk is some kind of game changer is nonsense. We will continue to advance. And we have immensely powerful military capabilities of our own, capabilities that go far beyond whatever threat the Tomahawk might potentially pose to us. So it was an unyielding message. And as I said, I think this is something that Westerners perhaps don't fully take into account. On the question of the seizure of ships, Russian ships or ships which trade with Russia on the high seas, by the way, Putin made again some interesting points. He said that this is straightforward piracy. I believe it is. I am not an expert on the law of the sea, but I understand that seizing ships on the high seas, though it is done all the time now, just to say, that seizing ships on the high seas without proper cause probably does fall within the international legal definitions of piracy. And for those who still imagine pirates to be people who belong in the 18th century, all I would say is that piracy is still a real problem and is still an international maritime crime. Not though one that I personally don't know very much about. Just saying. Anyway, that's what Putin had to say about that. But he also said more to say. He also said that, again, if this kind of game is played, let's just assume, he said, let's enter into the mind game of thinking that it succeeds, that the West does entirely stop Russia's ability to export oil by seizing ships on the high seas. He said he'd heard this expression, shadow fleet. He's absolutely baffled by it. He doesn't know what it means. By the way, he's right. There is no such thing as a shadow fleet. As I've explained many times, as we've explained on the Duran many times, the expression shadow fleet has no actual meaning. What it covers is ships that transport Russian cargoes and which are not insured in London, which is no longer the centre of maritime insurance anyway, as long ago, decades ago, it once was. But anyway, he says, let's assume this is successful. Let's assume that you really do interrupt our oil exports. What is that going to do to you? He said that oil prices will inevitably rise because there will be an oil shortage. Prices could go up to $100 a barrel. And how does that work to your advantage? Anyway, that is what Putin said. I am not going to explore this further in this programme. But anyway, that's what he had to say about this. And he did say that this is, again, an escalatory measure. And he again floated the possibility that if the Western powers start seizing ships on a regular basis, others can also play at that game too. Though he left it open whether the Russians would be amongst those who would join in that game. Anyway, there it is. Overall, a very tough set of messages from Putin in his Q&A. He didn't, as far as I can see, concede on any point at all. He didn't water down any of the conditions that he has set out, both the conditions that he set out at the start of the special military operation, or the conditions that he set out in his speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024. He still clearly expects to achieve peace, a negotiated peace, should one happen on that basis. He makes it fairly clear that the Russians, while they would be open to negotiating their way to achieving those conditions, if they can't do that, they will continue the special military operation, and they believe that they are winning, and in fact, they don't feel under any pressure to do otherwise. So on the substantive issues, he's made no concessions at all. And on various other specific points, he's made no concessions either. On the contrary, on the one point where up to now he has been more sympathetic to Ukraine's aspirations and the desires of the Western powers than other leaders of the Russian elite have been, on the question of Ukraine's eventual membership of the EU, I think this Q&A now makes it reasonably clear that he is starting to shift his position and is beginning to align it or realign it closer to that of the hardliners. Anyway, that is my assessment of Putin's Q&A. As I said, much less accommodating perhaps than people understand. Yes, the door is open for further and future diplomatic engagement with the Trump administration and with Donald Trump himself. But as Putin himself would say, if he were ever asked, it has never been closed. The Russians have never rejected talks with the Americans, with any US president. Putin has never refused to speak with US officials or US presidents. And, well, there's no reason to expect him to change on that now. Anyway, that's Putin. I wanted to clarify, as I said, what Putin actually said over the course of his Q&A, because I think it's important in itself, and I think perhaps not everybody has understood it fully and entirely clearly. Now, that, of course, brings me back to the situation in the war itself. And last night, we had another major combat, well, not over the last 2 nights, actually, we've had major Russian drone and missile attacks. And it's quite clear to me that at the moment now, the Russians are mostly focused on attacking Ukraine's energy system. In fact, there is further reports that northeast Ukraine is now in a state of blackout, and that large parts of the Ukrainian energy system are basically breaking down. And remember, because of the vast production of Geryon drones and Ukraine's increasing inability to shoot them down, and as the Financial Times pointed out recently, Ukraine, the Western air defense missiles also increasing inability to shoot down Russian missiles. Well, because of that, Ukraine is more vulnerable to, much more vulnerable to these drone and Russian attacks on its energy system than it has been at any point previously in the war. Now, one of the strange things about this story is not that the Russians would want to attack Ukraine's energy system. I have expressed my own view that in 2022-2023, when the Russians first attacked the Ukrainian energy system, their primary objective was to deplete Ukraine's air defense system, which, by the way, they successfully did. The West then had to replace Ukraine's depleted air defense system with new air defense missiles supplied by the West, Patriots and Iris-Ts and all of those. But these two, as we have seen, have now become depleted in turn. But the Russians have always had, undoubtedly, an intention to conduct what John Helmer has called an electricity war against Ukraine. And they're doing it, I've no doubt at all, in support of their ongoing ground offensive. So it's understandable why the Russians would want to conduct these attacks on the Ukrainian energy system. You might deplore the humanitarian consequences, the suffering this causes Ukrainian civilians. But the military rationale here is fully explicable. What I have less ease understanding is Ukraine's persistent attempts to attack Russian oil refineries, given that the Russians are using the attack on their oil refineries and other energy facilities as their reason for attacking the Ukrainian energy system. The Russians have always set themselves up as the people who conduct war, specifically the war in Ukraine, in a humanitarian fashion, who don't attack civilian infrastructure. And they repeatedly say that the only reason why they're attacking Ukraine's civilian infrastructure is because Ukraine is attacking Russia's. And, of course, they are. Where the Biden administration at least went through the motions of pretending that it disapproved of Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil refineries, the Trump administration, on the contrary, is cheering Ukraine on as it does so, as, by the way, is much of the Western media. And what I find absolutely baffling about this is the extent to which many people, far too many people in the West, are buying into the narrative here. Firstly, it has been claimed that these attacks on the refineries, the Russian oil refineries, are disrupting Russia's energy oil export trade. Not true. Russia does export some refined gasoline and diesel. Diesel is barely affected as a result of these attacks. But what Russia mostly exports, as by the way do most oil exporters, including the United States, is crude oil. In the oil export trade, it is the importers who refine the oil, not the exporters. And there are lots of technical reasons why that is so, that I'm not going to waste time in this program getting into. So this is not disrupting Russia's oil trade because, well, Russia's oil trade, as I said, mostly crude oil and, by the way, diesel. Gasoline plays a far smaller role. Russia refines crude oil into gasoline, mostly for its own domestic use. And mostly, as is the case in most countries, motor vehicles, passenger vehicles, and of course, at the very higher end, for aircraft. Now, there's been wildly exaggerated claims about the damage that these drone attacks on oil installations, the oil refinery installations, are doing. Now, I've been checking out the situation in Russia, and from what I can tell, the gasoline shortage that existed in the summer has mostly abated. Claims about long queues in Russian gasoline stations appear to be not just exaggerated, but mostly untrue. I saw a YouTube video, by the way, of a young woman who visited various gasoline stations in Moscow and found no evidence of queues, no queues at all, in fact, and found that the gasoline stations were fully stocked up with gasoline. Now, the point is that this is an enormous industry spread out across the world's biggest country. On top of that, oil refineries, as anybody who has any experience and knowledge of industrial facilities, are huge, complex industrial facilities. They are also very resilient and are designed and structured for relatively rapid repair. It is very difficult to knock them out because a drone hits a refinery and causes some damage, and that this leads to a column of smoke going up into the sky. It doesn't mean that the refinery is out of action. It doesn't mean that it can't be repaired very quickly. It doesn't mean that there has been major disruption in the oil refining industry. Now, I say this because I read somewhere some really astonishing claims that the Ukrainians have managed to knock out supposedly 40% of Russia's oil refineries. From what I can tell, this treats every Ukrainian drone that hits an oil refinery as having knocked out the oil refinery and completely discounts the ability of the Russians to repair those refineries. It is a completely wrong way of approaching this claim. And again, obviously, we have the inevitable claims that repairing the refineries has become more difficult because of the Western sanctions. By now, 3.5 years into the war, the Russians will certainly have duplicated all of the equipment they need to repair the refineries. We're not talking about the absolute high-end technology here. And to the extent that they have not done that themselves, they will have been able to import the necessary equipment from their friends in China and other BRICS states and elsewhere. It is facile to think that this drone offensive can have anything like the kind of economic impact that people imagine. If Tomahawk missiles were to join this offensive, and if they were to be supplied in Ukraine in very large numbers, and if some means were to be found to launch them, all huge ifs, by the way, and if those attacks could be continued day after day, night after night, preventing repairs to the refineries, well then yes, that would make a difference, though it would take time. Given the low volume production of Tomahawk missiles, Reuters said that they are being produced at a rate of 50 to 100 a year. Jennifer Kavanagh, who I consider a more reliable source, believes that the true number is about 200 to 250, and that if the United States had to surge production, they might increase production to up to 500, which is what I believe was the case initially. Well, I'm going to say 500 missiles a year and a stockpile of 4,000 would probably not be enough to sustain the kind of offensive against the Russian oil industry long enough to basically knock it out of contention. Long before that point was reached, the United States would be running down its inventories, its absolutely vitally important inventory of Tomahawk missiles. To anybody who is not familiar with the stories, the complexities of destroying refineries, what I would suggest that they do is that they go to histories of the Second World War and study the difficulties the Western Allies had in knocking out the German oil industry and indeed the entirety of the German industrial base, despite the enormous air campaign that the Western Allies launched against Germany. It would give you a sense of the challenge. So why are the Ukrainians doing this? Why are they attacking refineries when all that's doing is giving the Russians the pretext the Russians need to attack Ukraine's energy facilities, which they're able to do, to far more devastating effect? And why does the Western media plug along with this? Well, the short answer is because not for the first time, it suits the narrative. There's been a good article by Ted Snyder in the American Conservative, which makes the point that Zelensky and his officials, the thing that they're best at is creating narratives. Before they were a government, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and many of the people who have surrounded him, including his chief of staff and closest advisor, Andrei Yermak, wrote and produced TV shows and movies. Writing scripts may be what they do best. And, well, I think that what we are seeing with the drone attacks on the Russian refineries is another case in point. It's another story. You get all of these pictures and films of the drones crashing into the refineries, of the plumes of smoke. You can spread stories about the Russian oil industry grinding to a halt, of the enormous pressure supposedly that is putting on the Russians when that happens. By the way, we've had more economic numbers from Russia over the last 24 hours, and I cannot see any evidence that these strikes are having any discernible effect on the Russian economy at all. Just saying. But anyway, put all that aside, it's an ill-conceived, in fact, misconceived narrative, but one which is clearly intended to impress, obviously, the population of Ukraine, but also people, first and foremost, in the United States and in the rest of the West. Now, there's been a most interesting article in the Kyiv Independent, which referenced an earlier article in the Wall Street Journal, which I admit I missed, which confirmed that the narrative, the Ukrainian narrative, that Ukraine is winning the war, was provided in a special briefing to President Trump by a group of his advisers, the leading advisor being General Kellogg, exactly as Alex and I suspected, though it turns out that the newly appointed US ambassador to the United Nations, Mike Wulff, President Trump's original national security advisor, and somebody who is widely known to be a extreme hardliner, a strong hardliner with basically neocon views, also appears to have participated in this briefing. I'm going to guess that other members of the US military, perhaps General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who General Kellogg says supports his views, that he also participated in this meeting, this briefing as well. And it's clear that collectively they set out to sell to Trump this idea that Ukraine is winning the war, that the Russian economy is in the process of crisis. Not that there's any actual evidence of that, but anyway, that's what they probably briefed the president, that what he needs to do then, therefore, is to take a hard line, and a hard line against the Russians. And probably that is where the idea of the Tomahawks, sending the Tomahawks to Ukraine, has come from. As I discussed in my program yesterday, it appears that following wiser counsels, that particularly bad idea is now being walked back. But always the risk is that this game of escalation is going to continue further. Well, I say this, particular narrative of Ukraine winning the war, just like the narrative about the attacks on the oil refineries, is going to be dropped before long because it is unsustainable and obviously wrong. Now, over the last 24 hours, as well as that massive combined missile and drone attack that the Russians conducted against Ukraine, which I spoke about earlier, the Russians have also provided, or at least Russian bloggers have provided, further information about the progress of what I still believe to be the key battle, which is the Battle of Pokrovsk. And it looks as if the Russians have managed, at least according to these reports, remember I myself am not there, but that they managed to capture one of the key fortified micro districts in the southeast of Pokrovsk. And judging by the latest maps that these people are providing, the Russians now control roughly two-thirds of Pokrovsk south of the railway line. In other words, around, well, a substantial part of the town, with the Ukrainians in southeast Pokrovsk, the major fortified area of Pokrovsk, the citadel area with the high-rise buildings, effectively cut off from supply and rapidly losing ground. Now, it is likely, and this is what I believe, that just as is probably going to happen before long in Siversk and perhaps Kupiansk, the Ukrainians will this time withdraw their forces from Pokrovsk. Just saying. For the moment, there is no confirmation of this. Zelensky and Sirski will presumably want to hang on in Pokrovsk for as long as they can, but it's increasingly looking as if the Ukrainian defences in the fortified area of northeast, southeast Pokrovsk is failing. The Russians capture this area and the whole of Pokrovsk south of the railways, and there are reports that they've crossed the railway line in the western part of Pokrovsk and are now attacking the Ukrainians in an area of factories and industrial plants to the northwest of Pokrovsk. Well, if the Russians capture all of the territory south of the railways, then I suspect the whole of Pokrovsk will fall. The Russians will be in control of around 70% of Pokrovsk. The northern areas will be untenable. And if the Russians capture this industrial area, they will be completely untenable. And a retreat from Pokrovsk, or a fall, a catastrophic fall of Pokrovsk, must then follow. And then, to repeat again the point I made in various programs, at that point, the other fortified cities, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, will start to fall. Maybe not as quickly as a row of dominoes, but in something like the same kind of sequence. Presumably, Konstantinovka first, where General Gerasimov, the chief of the Russian General Staff, and Putin have now both said that the Russians are already fighting inside its urban limits. Probably the biggest of the three towns, Kramatorsk, next. And it's difficult to see how without Konstantinovka, Kramatorsk can be defended. And then ultimately the last place, which would be Slavyansk. And then all of Donbass, every part of Donbass, will have passed entirely under Russian control. And elsewhere, more reports that the situation of the Ukrainian forces in Kupiansk is now absolutely desperate. Their lines of retreat have apparently been cut off. The decision to have them withdraw ought to have been made at least a week ago, but again never was. And it's been suggested that their only effective line of retreat now would be by swimming across the Oskol River in autumn with the weather turning cold. I can't imagine anyone trying to do something like that with the Russian drones flying overhead and the Russian infantry in pursuit, but there it is. And I suspect we're going to get further news from Siversk as well. So the president has been misinformed. Zelensky and Sirski spin these narratives. People in the West want to believe them. Their friends in Washington, I think, do believe them. There was clearly a concerted attempt in September to bring the president into line. The president, who, as Jennifer Canvaner, by the way, has recently said in various interviews and places, the president, who is terrified of being blamed for the fall of Ukraine, under pressure from these people, shifted his stance, agreed to provide Ukraine intelligence, more intelligence, for deep strikes against Russia, and mulled the reckless and perhaps unworkable idea of providing the Tomahawk missiles. But ultimately, as Putin said, none of that is going to change the realities, because the realities remain the realities. The Russians continue to advance, and Putin continues to be in overall control of the situation. I will be very interested to know what happens when, in a few weeks or months' time, Donald Trump starts to understand that the stories that he has been fed by his trusted advisors are wrong. Will he turn on them and sack them? Or will he do what he has always done throughout his current term? Will he continue to keep them on, listening to them, unable to make his own decisions, or sort out his own mind, or recognize the realities in Ukraine, which is staring him in the face? Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.